Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Tim Robbins has had a very successful movie career as an actor and director. You know him from his performances in films like Mystic River, The Shawshank Redemption, The Player, Bob Roberts, or what I'm told is his favorite, Bull Durham, filmed here in North Carolina. But this actor, director, producer, and screenwriter is a longtime activist, fighting for causes near and dear to him, and it is that intersection of his professional career and his politics that brings him to Charlotte. Tim Robbins helped develop a new play that starts its national tour tonight at the Knight Theater. The New Colossus features 12 actors telling the stories of 12 refugees coming to America. It's a production of the Actors Gang, which Robbins founded in the early 1980s. From its inception, that group has expressed political observations through theater. So, in advance of the New Colossus opening here tonight, we explore this new play with Tim Robbins, who joins us right now in our Spirit Square studio. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you here. You're looking at me funny. I'm going to be intimidated now. Piercing eyes. You come from a show business family. I didn't know this about you. Your mom was an actress.
She was a singer.
Okay.
Actually, yeah.
And so was your dad.
My dad
also an actor, but he was a part of the Highwaymen, right?
Yes.
Michael rode the boat ashore. Hallelujah.
Yep. Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Is that where this melding of... I don't know, because they're both kind of, you were living in Greenwich Village, and it was kind of a bohemian atmosphere. Is that where this came from in you, this melding of show business and activism?
Yeah, I think it came from the neighborhood. It came from my parents. It came from growing up at a time that was so rife with debate and political engagement in the 60s and early 70s. And you can't help but be affected by that. Greenwich Village was kind of the ground central for a lot of the progressive movements at the time.
Were you aware of that back then, or did it just seem normal to you?
It's funny because you're not. You think all the world is like this, and it wasn't until I went to college that I understood that the rest of the world wasn't.
And you went to UCLA.
I did, but the first 2 years I went to... a state college in upstate New York called Plattsburgh State.
Okay.
And then I transferred to UCLA when I was a junior.
Born in California, raised in New York City. What was UCLA like for somebody who was on the East? I don't like the West Coast, so I mean, I just think I don't like it. So
okay.
What was your reaction?
Fine. well, I love it. I spent my first 3 years of life in West Covina, California. And then gracefully, my father found Greenwich Village and raised the family there. And then when I went to college, I still had family out there. My grandparents were there, and my brother was living there. At first, it's difficult, you know, when you're young and trying to make your way, and you're living in a town that you have to drive everywhere. But I figured it out, and there's communities out there and then I found a bunch of like-minded people in UCLA, and we started this theater company in 1982, and we're still together.
That's the Actors Gang, which is the group that's bringing this play tonight, The New Colossus, to the Knight Theater. You started workshopping this play. I haven't seen this. This is a very odd interview, because I have usually see the plays before I talk about them. But I haven't seen this because it opens tonight. You started workshopping this 2 years ago with the Actors Gang. What does that involve? For people who don't know theater, what does that involve, workshopping a play?
Well, I had been working on a Shakespeare before that, and I had these incredible actors for whom English was a second language. And I wanted to work with them, but they were struggling with the Shakespeare, so I wanted to develop a piece that they could shine in. And so I started asking them to start speaking in their original languages. We work in a style. The training we do has to do with words coming from a full emotion. And that's okay for people that speak English, but when you have to translate, you have to go through the head. And so it was not as easy for them to come from a visceral place. And so I just said at workshop, I just started telling them, speak in the original language, speak the passion from that, you know, without going through your head to translate. And I discovered these amazing actors through this. And so I wanted to develop a piece for them. And so we started talking about immigration. We started talking about the refugee crisis in Syria. And I asked them to research their own origin stories, the stories of their ancestors. And they started talking to their family members. Oftentimes, you know, family members don't want to leave the past behind, the language behind. They don't want to tell the stories. And I encouraged them to reach out. And at first they met resistance, and then eventually the walls started to break down, and they started to discover truths that they hadn't known about their own ancestors, stories of migration. Really difficult stories. It's why the families wanted to leave them behind. They didn't want to talk about the pain that they went through to get here and the struggle that they had to get here. And eventually they wrote these stories and we performed them. The first time we did it, there was no English at all. And then we wanted to incorporate the story of migration within the United States. So an African-American member of our company brought a story of the Northern migration, of fleeing the South after the Civil War when the rise of the Ku Klux Klan created a difficult environment for them to live in. And so we performed this play for about a three-month run. It was very successful. We started to discover when we were doing the play that when the end of the play came, that there was more stories to tell, and they were in our audience. And so we started reaching out at the end of the play to ask the audience to tell their origin stories. And that's when the piece started to really flourish, because we take people on a journey, and then at the end we ask them to reflect on that journey and reflect on how it relates to their own story.
So if the first time you did this, it's all in different languages, you're the director, you're shaping the piece, you don't speak all these languages, one presumes, not all of them, maybe some of them. How do you work? How do you shape it? How do you know what it is that you're dealing with?
Well, I ask them, you know, what are you saying? and they wrote it down in English for me. And then the second time was really when the piece came to life, because then I could shape it poetically, and because they started speaking in English. And when we're doing it at the Night Theater, it's mostly in English. There's a couple sections that are translated in supertitles, like you would see in an opera.
Right.
And but it, at the core, you know, one of the things that we've discovered with some audiences is that even if they don't understand English, because we did it in South America last year, And the play still works. The people understand emotionally what's happening. There's a lot of physical movement in it. A lot of it is about the struggle of the journey and how tiring and how difficult that is. But it's also about waiting, and it's also about building a fire to survive. All these primal things that everybody understands.
Right.
But then we started developing the poetry of it, and what we're doing in Charlotte is reflective of that.
Immigration, we're all from someplace else, almost all of us, but immigration has become this political topic now. You can't have a conversation about it without being very careful what you say it to and knowing who you're talking to, because everybody has a very stern opinion about immigration. But you say that this is not a political play.
I don't believe it is. I believe it's a celebration of who we are as a country. As you say, everyone's from somewhere else. At the end of the play, I come out and I ask, first of all, are there any indigenous people here?
How many hands go up?
Well,
depends on where you are.
Depends on where we are, but usually three or four people in the audience. Last night we did a meet the audience event here, and there were four people from various nations. And after that, I ask, is anyone descended from ancestors that were brought here against their will? And African Americans will raise their hand. And I say, do you know where from or what year? No, we don't. Which is one of our original sins, the idea that we kidnapped and enslaved a whole race of people and then eliminated their history and their culture. And then after that, I ask if there's any refugees in the audience, and some hands come up. Where from, what year? Any immigrants? Where from, what year? Then, any sons or daughters of immigrants or refugees? More hands come up. Grandsons, granddaughters of immigrants or refugees? More hands come up. Great-grandsons, great-granddaughters of immigrants or refugees? More hands come up. Anyone back to the Mayflower? More hands come up. Before you know it, the whole audience has raised their hand. And what is nice about it is that people understand at that point, well, yeah, this is our story. Well, the story we've been saying, we tell the story of people from 1868 to 2017. Last night, we had four people that were descended from the Mayflower in our audience. And they knew the names.
Oh, my goodness.
Called out their names. This is, I think, what kind of makes us great as a country and unique. If you think about it, you think about what if you, the concept of a collective DNA. What is that? What makes us up? Well, first of all, we're descended from people that said no. They said no to famine. They said no to religious oppression. They said, no, we will not live in this environment anymore. We will risk our lives to get out of it. We're descended from people that said no to fascism and communism. And then they got here. A lot of people didn't make the choice to leave. We're not descended from that DNA. A lot of people made this arduous journey and didn't make it. We're not descended from that DNA. And then a lot of people made that journey over the ocean and somehow landed with nothing and created a life, created a future. We're descended from that DNA. And if you think about it that way, something we share, which is kind of mythic. I believe it's a hero's journey. And I believe the people that are doing that journey today are risking their lives to do it with no assurance that they will be allowed in. Think about that. That's a pretty brave thing to do. Yeah. And also desperate because they're fleeing from something that they find intolerable. And they will not tolerate that future for their children. And they make the choice to risk their lives to try to find a better future. I think there's something deeply inspiring in that, and I think that's something that we also can understand is our ancestor's story, whether it's two generations ago, five generations ago, or yesterday. It's a common link that we all have. And in these times of division, I think it's really important to try to tell stories that remind us that we have so much in common in this country, so much that we share.
Did you come up with this DNA philosophy on your own? Because it's like the survival of the fittest. We are descendants of people with really the best DNA because they survived.
Yes, yes.
Did you come up with this on your own, or is this something that you read about and decided this is applicable to this
situation? Well, I started talking about it when I started doing this show, so I don't know if I came up with it on my own, but I do believe it is part of the character of who we are. It's a complicated history, though. Mm-hmm. Because part of that DNA also had to do with the oppression of other people. But if you think about the idea of what it is to survive, I do believe there's something very inspiring in that.
Tim Robbins is our guest, director, actor, screenwriter, and founder of the Actors Gang. They brought their play, The New Colossus, to the Knight Theater. It opens tonight. It's the first stop on a tour, a national tour. And you can get tickets. They're still available at blumenthalarts.org. We will continue our conversation with Tim Robbins about that play and much more as we go through the rest of this hour. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tim Robbins is here. You know him from Shawshank Redemption and Mystic River and many, many, many other movies and television shows, including one on HBO, which I loved, called Here and Now. It lasted one season. It should have gone on for a long time, but That such is show business, I suppose. And he's here with The New Colossus. It's a play that he helped develop with his organization called the Actors Gang out of Los Angeles. It opens tonight at the Knight Theater. As you have been workshopping this and performing this in L.A. before you put it on its tour, one of the things you do is have these talkbacks following the show to find out where people come from. You were kind of talking about that. What are some of the things you've learned from that, some of the stories that
you've
heard?
Well, one of the reasons I'm out on the road, I'm going to go to every show, is because I get so much out of it. It's amazing, the experience. The stories you hear, one story I heard, a woman says, I want to tell you about my grandmother. She was 8 years old when she came to this country on a boat by herself with only a picture of a relative, a photograph of a relative. No name and no address, just a picture. And she lands in New York Harbor, this 8-year-old girl, and somehow in New York City finds this person, finds the community, and they shows the picture and they say, oh, we know her, right? The reason that woman is in this audience in the 21st century is because of that 8-year-old girl and her tenacity and her courage and her ability to survive. It was so inspiring. Another woman tells me, let me tell you about an American soldier, okay? He's liberating a concentration camp in Buchenwald, a private. And he sees this woman start to falter, start to stumble. And he starts walking towards her. And his sergeant says, stand down, private. That's not what we're doing right now. He disobeys his sergeant, gets to this woman right before she falls, catches her, carries her to the medic, gets in trouble with his sergeant. After he's out of trouble, goes and visits this woman in a field hospital. This woman says to me, that was my mother and my father.
Mm.
Amazing stories. Stories of being in refugee camps for years and getting the chance to go to America and then being sent to another place and going to another place and eventually winding up here. There's so many deeply inspiring stories. Every time we do the show, and we're going to do this at the Knight Theater, which I'm really excited about, is we put a map of the world up in the lobby. And we ask people coming in to put pins on the places where their ancestors are from. And every night in Los Angeles when we did this, the entire world was represented in our audience. And if you think about that, where else in the world would you find that?
Yeah.
It's something that's truly amazing and unique about this. We don't think about it a lot. We tend not to think of, well, you know, I'm sitting next to someone that is descended from someone from the Mayflower, you know, but this gives us an opportunity to understand that and for people to tell their stories. And last night, after the little talk we did, people were, after we finished, stayed and were talking with each other. And usually, you know, you see in the theater, people want to get to their cars.
Get to the parking lot.
Yeah. But they were staying and talking and engaging with each other and understanding new things about
each
other.
You talk about that experience, which sounds like a great experience. I mean, play aside, just talking about it, learning that, and seeing that map in the lobby. And you tell these stories, which are all amazing and inspirational. And we hold some of these stories up. I've been in classes where they say, look, this guy came to America with a dollar in his pocket, and he became Andrew Carnegie or a millionaire. These are inspirational stories that one would aspire to. And yet, historically, when we talk about immigrants who are arriving today, I don't care whether it's today or 1860 or 1912, we don't want them.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Irish need not apply.
Right. Why is that?
I don't know. My suspicion is it's historically the same as what is happening now, which is that it's divisive rhetoric spoken by politicians that want to divide people, divide and conquer. It's been a time-honored strategy to stay in power, divide and conquer. As long as they're fighting with each other, they're not going to notice what we're doing. They're not going to notice our corruption. And that's not Republican or Democrat, by the way. That's on both sides.
Right.
That's not. I'm not talking about, you know, I'm not trying to denigrate.
Well, in fact, this play grew out of the Syrian refugee crisis, and people will think, see, Trump, see, he's a problem.
Oh, we started
the Obama administration.
That's right. We started during the Obama administration. He was called the, you know, deporter in chief. It's been a long-standing problem, and I think it's gotten worse, and I certainly think that there's more to blame than I, you know, this idea that it's all about one person. I think there's a system that's in place that is perpetuated, and I think that historically it's the people that have to change things and have changed things. It doesn't happen from the top up. It happens from the ground. It happens from the grassroots, and it's people demanding a better way that creates change.
The title of this play is The New Colossus, and that's not a mistake.
No.
That's purposeful. That's the title. Is that the title of the sonnet that Emma Lazarus has at the base of the Statue of Liberty?
Yes. The New Colossus. Mm-hmm. Give me your tired, your poor, your hungry, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shores. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I will light my lamp beside the golden door.
She wrote that poem to raise money for the pedestal on which the Statue of Liberty stands. Did you do any research? I'm just curious if you know. I don't. Maybe you don't. When she says something like, your wretched refuse, did that go over well with the people giving them money for the pedestal?
Well, that's funny. You know, what I love about that line is that it's saying we're strong enough as a country to take people that are truly in trouble, truly needy, hungry, homeless, tempest-tossed. We are strong enough, and I am strong enough to say not only welcome, but I'm going to light my lamp to guide you safe passage into this harbor. It's what I grew up believing America to be.
Yeah.
You know, when I was young, I was in a nonprofit theater company when I was 13 years old, and the first time I ever got paid to act was with this company. And they were funded by the NEA. And we were doing political satires that were that was critical of the government. And I remember thinking at the time, what a great country I live in, that they can fund dissent.
Yeah.
That's strength. That's knowing that our tenets, our laws, our Constitution is strong enough, and our people are strong enough to take a hearty discussion, to take dissent.
Yeah.
Even from our artists, we'll support them. And then it's got more and more tribal. It's gotten more and more, you know, difficult for artists in the country. We at the Actors Gang don't rely on that kind of support because we don't feel it's consistent enough to survive. And we've been together for 38 years now. And so we rely on private support, donor support. And occasionally we'll convince a government agency to fund one of our education programs or the work we do in prison. And, you know, we wouldn't be able to do the prison work we do without the support of the Department of Corrections in the state of California, the governor's office. So we've learned how to work with this system. But you know, it's a big tent. We have it's important to be able to have these kinds of discussions and not go into a discussion saying, I'm right, and I'm just going to, you know, listen to you obligatorily for a while, and then I'm going to state my opinion. You have to, particularly in prison, you have to have humility when you go in. If you're going to get these men and women to really affect some kind of transformational change within themselves, you can't go in as an authoritarian saying, I know what I'm doing, you're going to listen to me, you do this. It's never going to work. And that's something I've learned in the last 15 years when I've been working in prison, that this very important thing, that you can't be the expert. No one is an expert. We're all figuring this out together. And as an artist, it's been a huge gift to be able to do that work, because I've realized there's so much I still have to learn. There's still so much daily that I can grow with, figure out new things, and figure out new ways of dealing and overcoming problems.
You're the founder of this group, the Actors Gang, and also the artistic director. I think it's been around for, what, 38 years.
Yeah.
Years. It's an eternity for a theater company.
For a nonprofit,
yes. Yes, it's an eternity. But aside from the work that you produce for audiences that come to see your shows, and this one that is at the Knight Theater beginning tonight, as you said, you go into prisons. You also are, you send people into the unified school system in Los Angeles to teach elementary, middle, and
high school.
High school students.
Yeah. Oftentimes in continuation high schools, which is, which means it's either that or prison. You know, it's kids that are in trouble. And when we go into prison, we ask for the people that are the most difficult. We ask for the shot callers. We ask for the people that are gang leaders. We want to have it so that we have racially mixed and across gang lines. And so that's the whole purpose of the work. We don't want the well-behaved, because they're already, you know, trustees, and they're already doing okay.
Right.
So we start there, and somehow the work that we do, we found out, like 13 years ago, we found out, oh my goodness, this works. This actually has an effect on these
What
people.
Has been the result of that, both in the school system and also in the prisons? What's been the result?
Well, in the prisons, it basically what it does is it allows these people to find emotions that they have not been in touch with for many years. We do that by allowing them to play characters from the Commedia dell'arte, which is a 500-year-old art form from Italy, and stock characters. The rich old man that wants his young daughter to marry one of his business associates, and she's in love with this young man who doesn't have as much money, and the servants somehow figure out a way in the course of every scenario to humiliate the master and for true love to survive. And they told these stories in the public square. So it's kind of the people's theater. They were also talking about power, the power of, you know, love over the power of the purse. And so in a ways, it was a subversive story. And so they were kind of itinerant companies. They would do their show and then get the hell out of town, because mm-hmm. they were in danger of whatever satire they had done that day. And so they play these characters, which allows them to express emotion. And you have to understand, in prison, there's one predominant emotion. It's anger. It's your mask. It's what the guys tell us after they start to put the makeup on. They start saying, you know, I didn't realize I was wearing a mask on the yard for the last 30 years, because I'm worth more than this angry mask. The angry mask is to survive. That's your emotion in prison. If you show fear, if you show sadness, if you show happiness, it is compromising. You will be compromised. So this is a room that allows them to not only get in touch with these emotions, but start to share these emotions. And there's a particular exercise we do that's really moving. And what I would do is I take them to a funeral and of one of the characters. And I ask them all to reflect and to say something under their breath about the person that's died, and to place a flower in the grave. And you can see that they're visibly, you can see that they're really in a state of sorrow. Whether they're cooking up funerals they've been to or funerals they couldn't attend because they've been incarcerated, funerals of parents and sisters and brothers. And then I ask them, after they've all reflected, I ask them to look at each other. And that's the moment when all the walls start to break down, because they look at each other and they understand they're looking in the eye of their former enemy, and they see a shared sorrow, a shared empathy. And this is what starts to shift it. And then I say, if you want to, you can comfort the other person. And then you see former enemies start to embrace. And that's when it changes, because that bond is a deeper bond than the superficial bond that got them into that gang in the first place.
Wow. And where did you learn this?
Where did I learn it?
Yeah.
I learned the form from a French actor named Georges Bigot, who was in Los Angeles in 1984 with his theater company called the Théâtre du Soleil from Paris. And he stayed behind and ran this workshop in the Commedia dell'Arte. And it had a profound effect on me because I started to understand, first of all, if you're going to be on a stage, you owe the audience a lot. And he would kick me off stage every time I would enter. And I was a working actor at this point, you know, I was a professional actor. And I'd make entrances and he'd go, no, get off. And I was like, what am I doing wrong? I get paid for this. No, stop. No, go back. And so it was about 4 days of this, and I started having back problems, and I was like, you know. And then I watched an actor named Simone Upkarian enter, and I saw this beautiful state of emotion, and I was my eyes were drawn to it, and it was immediate theater from the very first moment he stepped on stage. And then I understood what he was talking about. And George said something that really formed my consciousness about theater, which was, never assume that any of these people that are sitting in your audience could afford this ticket. Always assume they spent their last dollar on it and had to walk 5 miles because they couldn't afford the bus. That's what you owe everyone that makes that social contract with you, that says, I'm going to spend time with you in this space. And that's the way we approach it at the Actors Gang, that the audience is why we're there. And, you know, some theater company actors, some people, you know, you'll hear this, you'll hear, oh, that show was horrible. That audience sucked.
Yes.
And we don't tolerate that in our theater because, no, you didn't meet that audience, that particular audience, because every audience is a different conglomeration of people. You're never going to get that same chemistry anywhere again.
That's what makes it special.
Yeah.
Every night's different.
Yeah.
On both sides of the footlights.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tim Robbins is our guest. He's a director. He's the developer of the new Colossus and the founder and artistic director of the company that's bringing the play here, The Actors Gang. It opens tonight at the Knight Theater, runs through Sunday. You can get tickets at blumenthalarts.org. We're coming right back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tim Robbins is here. His play, The New Colossus, which he helped develop with his organization, The Actors Gang, out of Los Angeles, opens its national tour tonight at the Knight Theater, blumenthalarts.org, for tickets. I'm sorry. We were coming back on the air. You were saying you could tell the story about...
Oh, well, you know, it's irrelevant now because there was a siren passing, right?
We didn't hear it.
And when we do the play in Los Angeles... anytime a siren passes, everyone hides.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, great. It's so immediate because, we're in a soundproof theater tonight, so that won't happen. But
you also work with kids. You've talked about the prisoners. These kids that you work with in the L.A. school system, as you say, you don't want to work with the well-adjusted. You want to work with the kids who are struggling and who are having problems. And at the elementary, the middle, and the high school level. High school, I understand. But I kind of understand the elementary school because I've read to kids in elementary school. And in the first and second grades, their eyes are bright and they're like saucers. Mm. You could be reading just a little stupid little children's book and they just love it. Mm. They're into the story. Then you get to the third or fourth grade. And you can look into the eyes of some of the kids, and the light has been extinguished. It's gone out.
You're right. You're right.
And those are the kids you're working with.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's kind of the way I look at it is, it's the same way, you know, in prison, there's four emotions. There's happiness, sadness, anger, and fear. From the very start, a child is told, don't be sad. What are you angry about? Don't you give me any lip. What are you scared of? Don't be a scaredy cat. Mm. Think about that. The messaging that happens to a child.
Don't.
Just be happy. well, sorry, but that's not the way life is. And so to allow the kids a space where they can play these characters and be furious and be terrified and be absolutely devastated in sadness, it allows them the legitimacy of their emotions. It's what the arts and theater can do for in education. It's why I believe it's absolutely essential as math and science and English. Because we're talking about the idea of being able to stand in your own feet and know what you are and who you are. And a kid that is able to express themselves honestly is going to stand a much better chance in life. I work with kids that when they walk in the first day, it's like they're traumatized. They can't make eye contact. They're reserved. They're shut off. And we start playing games with them. And the games have to do with collective achievement, not with individual achievement. They're not competitive games. It's not about winning. It's about winning together. It's how do we do this thing together so that we achieve success. And so they start understanding that they're part of a group first, and then they start seeing other kids start to express emotions. And they're not being made fun of. They're not being, oh, you're weird or anything like that. No, please, be weird. Express yourself. And they start laughing at things that other people are doing. And then at the end, we do a little check-in, and we say, what did we see today that was fun? Or, and they start calling out people's names, and kids starts to feel a sense of accomplishment. It's not about taking a test. It's about being in the moment and being able to be present with the people around you. Make eye contact. One of the major things in a job interview, of course, as you know, is eye contact. If you can't make eye contact, you're not getting that job. And why are people so shut off? Well, a number of reasons. There's so many reasons, but we don't deal with that. We're not psychoanalysts. We don't.
Well, their confidence hasn't been boosted.
No, it hasn't.
They don't trust themselves.
No, because they've been told that they're not worthy. And it's not like the parent is saying you're not worthy. It's that they're simply unaware that some of the messaging that they're giving their children is denying what they're feeling. I read a super important book for me. It's called How to Talk So Your Kids Will Listen, How to Listen So Your Kids Will Talk. And it explains what a sullen teenager is. A sullen teenager is someone that has been told from the time they're 10 to the time they're 12 that their emotions don't matter. They come home from school and they say, my teacher's done this, blah, 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 blah. And you say, no, it's your teacher. He knows what's best. Well, the book says, how many great teachers have you had in your life? If we're lucky, we've had 3 really great, inspiring teachers. So take the kid's side. What's the big deal? It probably is a
teacher. But aren't more parents doing that today, taking the kid's side and not trusting the teacher?
Well, no, it doesn't mean you don't have to do your homework.
Right.
It's saying, my kid is in crisis. I have to listen to my kid. And it doesn't mean that the teacher's wrong. It's that the teacher's overwhelmed. He's got 30 kids in the classroom, and he might have lashed out and made my kid feel terrible. So why not say, I hear you. I understand. That's horrible, right? You still have to do your homework, but I get it. I was there myself. Another thing happens in middle school. Kid comes home. He's been friends with this kid since kindergarten. Kid comes home. Says, Judy has now excluded me from the clique. My best friend from kindergarten has now excluded me. And we as parents try to make it better from our own experience, put it in perspective. Hey, it's not that big of a deal. It's not, I'm sure Judy didn't mean it. Well, think about it. The kid's in crisis. You should respond like you would with your partner. If your partner comes home and says, my boss yelled at me and this, you're not going to say, well, I'm sure your boss had the reason to do it. So it's about receiving the kid, right? And it's about saying, oh my good, I don't know what I would do if I was in that situation. Well, I don't that situation. That's That's horrible.
Terrible, yeah.
That's horrible. That she's your best friend from kindergarten. It allows a line of communication to remain open through those crucial years so that they're not sullen teenagers, not shutting the door on you because their emotions and their crisis has been denied for three straight years.
So we've talked a lot, it's kind of like therapy, but we've talked a lot about how you work with young people and how you work with prisoners. I'm curious how many of the techniques that you use with them also come into play when you're directing fellow professionals. I mean, you drew Academy Award nominated, and in one case, an Academy Award winning performance out of Sean Penn and Susan Sarandon in
Dead Man
Walking. Thank you. When you're working with people of that caliber as a director, how much do you have to do?
Get out of the way. No, that was a real joy to watch them work together. Robert Altman, who I worked with before I directed my first film, I learned so much from. And one of the things that was great about him was his love of actors. And his belief that the creativity of the actor should be, the freedom should be allowed. He said it's 90% in the casting. And then let them go. Mm-hmm. Let them do what they do. Your job as a director is to make sure they don't fall off the cliff, right? And also to make sure that the shots are dynamic and that you create the film of it. But it's such a joy to work with actors. Having been an actor before I directed, I understand the process they go through. The only thing that bothers me is when an actor starts trying to be the director. That's difficult because it doesn't mean their ideas are wrong. It's just that when you're trying to create something, you want one vision.
Right.
And if it's one person's vision, it stands a lot better of a chance of being successful.
You can't do it by committee. It has to
Somebody
has to be the boss. Dennis emails, your performance in Arlington Road, which I think I interviewed you for that, was outstanding. He said, paranoia was part of the plot. Do you think paranoia is worse today than it was in 1999?
Why? What are you saying that? Why are you saying that? What are you implying? I think there's a lot of conspiracy theories around right now. They've always been around. It's always part of that underlying, darkness that's around. I try not to get involved in paranoia.
Yeah.
It's not a productive thing. What it also winds up with is blaming others for situations that you can actually change.
Yeah.
It's like a crutch.
I know that I interviewed you for Bob Roberts, and I want to talk about Bob Roberts because in that you play this right-wing millionaire guy who is a self-proclaimed populist. He criticizes the liberal media. He's an entertainer. He's a folk singer, or he sings with a guitar, and he's focusing in on the resentments of Pennsylvania voters as he's running for U.S. Senate.
Ladies and gentlemen, why can't you get ahead? Why can't you have the home of your dreams? The fast car? A nice vacation? Why has your American dream been relegated to the trash heap of history? I'll tell you why. Because of the wasteful social programs of Brickley Paste. Let's cut taxes. Let's make it possible for the working man to keep the money he earns. Vote for me, and I will bring the values of the common man to bear in Washington, D.C.
I forgot that he loves beauty pageants.
Yes, he loves beauty pageants. So there are a remarkable number of parallels in that film to what's happening today. It was released in 92. You wrote it. You directed it. You were in it. How were you so prescient?
Well, I'm sorry.
the Brickley Pace, his opponent, was played by Gore Vidal.
Yeah.
Also got a chance to talk to him. the most frightening experience of my life in front of a microphone.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Because he was trying to trip me up at every turn.
Oh, he was sharp.
Yeah, he was sharp.
I was really blessed to know him. And he gave us such a beautiful gift with his performance in that, because he had such insight into the American political process. You know, he grew up in it. His grandfather was a senator, blind, and he would read to him on the Senate floor. So he was steeped in that world for many years. So I remember when we interviewed him, it wasn't on the schedule. And the producers were like, you know, you can't shoot anything extra. You're, you know, over schedule and we're over budget, and we got it. And I told the production designer, I said, listen, give me a desk, give me a flag, make it look like a senator's office. We're going to have 45 minutes. I'm not going to tell the producers, but we got to get this. Mm-hmm. And we did it. And that, it created this really, this other depth to the film.
Did you write that for him, or did he just...
Oh, that was him extempore.
Extemporaneously, yeah. I figured it might have been that way. Yeah. I don't want to spend a lot of time on Bob Roberts, but it just seems remarkably... do you think it ought to be re-released?
Well, I've asked. It's interesting with this new streaming platforms, and there's no video stores you can go to anymore, right. That it's really up to a cultural arbiter to decide whether you're going to see something, which I think is a dangerous thing. But at this point, I'm not making any money off of it, so if you want to illegally download it, go ahead.
Where would I do that?
I think you can find it. I'm just saying Google. I've been actually writing writing a new satire for this time about a rampant id in power. And I'm trying to put it together right now.
Yeah. You told Entertainment Weekly, I think it was back then, or that back then, when Bob Roberts was in the zeitgeist. It was around the beginnings of talk radio, which has become this thing, and it's almost been, which has now been eclipsed by Fox News. They're the power arbiters now, not necessarily talk radio, but they're certainly out there. And one of the things that disturbed you about it was the playing fast and loose with facts. On that medium, and now on Fox. And here we are today with this dangerous division in the country that seems the gulf is, you can't cross it. I mean, there's no way to bridge that gulf, it seems to me. Did you see that coming when you wrote this movie?
Well, I believe I did. The division, I'm glad you bring it up, because it's... I do believe it's surmountable. I believe there's a way back. I have to believe there's a way back to unity. I don't believe that that's through denying the struggle that people may have been going through that led to their voting for Trump. Mm-hmm. I think there's a truth there that oftentimes in our tribal discussions we don't acknowledge. And one of the things I've found with the new Colossus is that this is one way to bridge that gap. I don't want to believe that there are 60 million people that are that voted for this man that are irredeemable. I can't believe that. That can't be true. I believe there is good hearts amongst those people. And I believe that there's a possibility to find a common ground with some of them.
And maybe some of that can be found in the new Colossus, and maybe a better understanding on what happens for two immigrants, why they do what they do, why they come here, and the struggle that they went through to get here. It would be helpful. It opens tonight at the Knight Theater, runs through Sunday, LumenthalArts.org. It was developed by the Actors Gang, and our guest today, Tim Robbins. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.